Hi.
Hello.
Hello. This is the first episode of the Structures of Self podcast. My name is Aubrey Stark Miller.
And I'm Courtney Peacock. And we've never done this before, so we'll see how it goes today.
Yeah, first podcast. All right, so Courtney, tell us a little bit about yourself.
So, I am originally from a small-ish town in Oregon, Eugene, Oregon. Lived in Portland for a while and then came down to Austin about 9 years ago. I still can't believe I've been here for that long. It's crazy. Became a personal trainer and health coach about 2 years ago. And, yeah, it's a little bit about me.
Yeah. Let's see. My name's Aubrey. I am from Vermont originally. I am 32 years old. I have been in Austin similarly about, just about 8 years now. I came in the end of 2011 and grew up in a very small town in Vermont. You've never heard of it. And moved here on a whim with a friend.
Nice, similar. Mm-hmm. I moved on a whim too. Mm-hmm. I think a lot of people in Austin did that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely a lot of people moving for jobs and whatnot, but also moving to start a new phase of their lives.
Yeah.
Do a big shift. That was definitely what I was looking for. So why did you want to move to Austin?
Yeah, so it's interesting. I had a long-term boyfriend who we had talked a lot about moving away from Oregon because we both were from there and I lived abroad for a year, but other than that, I had been there like pretty much my whole life. And I slowly started to realize that he was very committed to staying in Portland because of his work. He's a designer and Portland's like Mecca for designers with Nike and Wieden and Kennedy and et cetera. So even though we had talked a lot about like selling all our stuff and driving across country and like whatever, we'd even bought like a Honda Element to do this in, or I had bought it. And I guess our relationship like started to fall apart, but very like subtly.
Mm-hmm.
And then actually, it's a really funny story. I cut my hair and it freaked him out. I won't go into, like, too much detail, but we got in, like, this huge fight, and I worked from home at the time, so I was like, I'm going to go visit my best friends in Austin and give this, like, a break and see what happens. And I was there for a month, and he came to visit at the end of the month, and it was just clear that we were, like, on totally different paths.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm an sometimes too spontaneous person, or, like, react just on, like, my gut or whatever, and I ended up breaking up with him, going back to Oregon, and just, like, leaving him all our stuff and moving down here, like, within 2 weeks.
Very short period of time.
Because I worked from home, so I was like, I can just go wherever.
Yeah, yeah.
And I had a lot of friends in Austin, so it just felt like San Francisco is another place I was considering, but the quality of life there is very different. Like, it's just extraordinarily expensive.
Mm-hmm.
So for having, like, my just like whatever my quality of life was, Austin was like almost identical to Portland. And then I knew like 12 or 15 people from Oregon and Austin, so I like immediately already felt really comfortable here.
You had like a tiny
and then
community.
The weather was like a huge player because I definitely had a lot of like seasonal depression growing up in Oregon and didn't even really realize it until I moved here and like came alive. I was like, holy cow, that's like, you know.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's looking back, it was like a very whimsical decision. And I think that it may have like caused, this is like a topic for another time, but I had to work through a few things with that because I did it so abruptly. But I've never like regretted it or anything. I think it was the right thing to do.
Yeah.
What about you?
Well, similarly, it's funny you mentioned the haircut thing. So when I was in my mid-20s in Vermont, I had lived in New Hampshire for a couple years, but I also just had grown up. I moved back to Vermont and most most of my time was spent in Vermont. And at the time, like within the year prior to moving to Austin, I was had dated this guy, not for very long, and he there was a period of time where I had decided I was gonna shave my head. And I went in the bathroom and I cut it pretty short, like a pixie, and then panicked and didn't shave it. But the interesting part was my boyfriend at the time saw my hair and how short it was. He didn't say a word. He went into the bathroom and shaved his head.
Whoa.
He could not have hair long or
Longer.
longer than mine. And that was an
Yeah.
interesting
Yeah, my ex was like
moment.
very traumatized by me cutting my hair, which like in hindsight, it's super fascinating to me.
So he and I broke up because he started dating someone else who had much longer hair.
That's totally why.
Yeah, that was the only reason. And I had actually been toying with the idea of Austin off and on for a few years. A lot of people, I was living in Burlington, Vermont, which is very small, quote unquote, metropolitan area, but I don't even know if you would classify it as that, but it's not like a rural town. And people would talk about San Francisco, they talk about Portland, they talk about Austin. And similarly, I was thinking along the lines of this is cheaper. You know, it was 2011. We're a couple years post-recession, and I was working in restaurants, and no one was really making very good money, and jobs were limited. And I just couldn't pull the trigger, though, on A, going by myself, and or B, like anyone that I would make plans to go with, it just always fell through. There was two or three people I think that I had talked about going to Austin with, or going to California, or going somewhere, and we just never made it happen. And then I had a shortly after this guy and I had broken up, I had a summer of like reckoning of what am I gonna do with myself? And I happened to have a roommate at the time who I had been roommates with for like a month. And he lets me know, hey, Aubrey, at the end of the summer, I'm actually going to move out and I'm going to move to Austin. And I said, oh, I've been wanting to go there. And I may have said something like, maybe I'll come visit you. I wasn't like, take me with you. But he said, why don't you come with me? And so within a month, it was about a month and a half later, we had all our stuff packed up.
Interesting.
And we just went.
Is he still
And
here? Yeah.
yes, he's still here doing his thing
Cool.
somewhere. And you know, I've heard people talk about how when you're in a period of unrest or a period where you're wanting change, that moving is not always the best way to do it, but I found that it actually did provide a lot of positive shifts for me. And one of them being like the weather. I was definitely super depressed all the time in Vermont. And like, I love my family and love friends, but there was something off. And being in Austin has completely shifted that.
Yeah, totally.
Had to work on a lot of other things, but it definitely was helpful in that regard.
Yeah. I've had a lot of thoughts on that with like you're not supposed to make big changes when you're going through big things, but for me, moving to Austin definitely like, and we'll talk about this at some point, but it like propelled me into a pretty chaotic period in my life. But I also think that that was necessary to end up where I am now. So in hindsight, it's really interesting because I was on a path of like a very structured, quote unquote, like normal. I worked in accounting in a cubicle for a few years. I lived in a high rise in Portland. My boyfriend had a really good job. You know, like I was like on track for that like picket fence life. Mm-hmm. And then moving here kind of like disrupted everything that I knew.
Mm.
And I think that it was challenging and I went through a really dark period in my life, but it almost like shook me out of following what society tells me to do and made me realize like the way that I really want to live my life, which I think is extremely powerful.
Sure, you know? Sure.
So it's like, I don't know.
I think
that disrupting my life like that unexpectedly was actually a really good move, even though a lot of people probably would have told me not to do it.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I mean, that's, yeah. There, for every person who's going to say, yes, do that, there's going to be,
right,
you know, five others saying, don't do that.
Right.
Yeah. When I felt that when I moved, I didn't disrupt the way I was structuring my life.
Mm-hmm.
Per se, in terms of, like, I went from working at a corporate restaurant mm-hmm. in Vermont to working at the same corporate restaurant in Texas, mm-hmm. and that was a big component where I thought, okay, I'm gonna move to Texas and everything's gonna be different.
Right.
I'm completely gonna new me,
right.
You know, but I still had these. It's really hard to change patterns of behavior.
Well, wherever you go, there you are.
Wherever you go, exactly.
Right.
And so I had the same thing, but there was something about changing my environment that had...
Hmm.
Now, I wasn't necessarily changing my social environment. Mm-hmm. I was hanging out with a lot of similar people as I had mm-hmm. been in Vermont, and I wasn't changing anything about my economic position. I was making the same amount of money, or lack thereof, and that had its own, you know, mm-hmm. stressors still that were continuous. But the physical environment, and I mean, yeah, like the sunshine and being mm-hmm. outside more. For me, I didn't have a car when I first moved here, so like walking mm-hmm. through, like walking to work daily was a big impact of just having more movement. But there were other things, and then I eventually could make those other shifts in terms of my job and in terms
right.
of my social environment. But yeah, that like I had to reckon with the fact that even though I moved somewhere different, I was doing the exact same thing.
Right.
And it was those other behaviors that were what I really wanted to change.
Right.
Yeah.
That's interesting.
So made lots of changes. You've made lots of changes. Mm-hmm. And then fast forward to now, there's been a lot in between.
Yeah.
So now we're sitting here making a podcast. So why do you want to make a podcast?
So I guess for me, looking back on, I mean, this ties into, so I don't drink. I'm sober from alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
And it kind of ties into that because in my profession as a personal trainer, I really love helping people with their health from the perspective of someone who's just like a little bit ahead of them. Like, mm-hmm. I don't think I have all the answers or that I've like figured it all out, but I do think that having like guidance when you're in a place of unrest or trying to like better yourself is really helpful. And when I stopped drinking, I tried to turn to podcasts and I found a few, but there, what was lacking for me was an exploration of more like psychology and science and just figuring out like more of the why behind what had happened to me with drinking.
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess it comes down to that, like just something that was missing for me when I was looking to podcasts for more answers. So when it came up with you, I feel like our conversations are exactly what I was looking for
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
3 years ago, and hopefully it can help someone else. That's really like my reason behind
it. Similarly, well, I don't drink alcohol either. I'm sober and have been for almost 2 years, and you know, how long you're doing it doesn't necessarily, you know, we can get into that another time.
Mm-hmm.
But But even before getting sober, I found myself curious about, you know, different areas of health. Like a few years ago, after I moved to Texas, I started getting into running and getting into food and diet and had all these questions about, well, why does this work this way? Why does this impact me? Why do I feel good when I work out?
Right.
And doing research on things. And I had started going back to U. I went to UT to finish my bachelor's degree a couple years ago. And having access to academic resources and being like, oh, wow, like the psychology and the neurological things that we just don't think about, we don't know about, is explains so much. And really, like, you know, just because you know why you do something doesn't mean you're going to change, but it helps. And my experience has been like, okay, knowing these chemical processes, I'm like, maybe I can start to shift things a little bit. And I did. So
I think, like, for me, I rebel if I don't understand something.
I have
to understand it in order to, like, try to follow through.
Or you get overwhelmed. You're like, well, what's going on with me? Why is my body doing these things? And so with when I stopped drinking, I started to wonder, like, why are people drinking as much as they are? And similarly, I was seeing, I found podcasts and I found a lot of blogs that were related to sobriety, and I did get some really good information there. But my biggest thing was saying, like, okay, we're talking about the drinking and the phenomenon of women drinking more, but that there's all these other questions about why are we drinking in the first place? Why are we stressed? And for me, I became very interested in the environmental impacts of, like, social environment, the built environment, literally what's going on in what your office or your neighborhood and your community that is causing stress levels that are leading to coping mechanisms, one of them being alcohol. So then I thought, well, we should just podcast about it.
So similar kind of. So yeah, we could go into, I guess, like, how sobriety has influenced our desire to change behaviors, but also that's kind of cyclical, I guess, like, what behaviors that you wanted to change drove you to seek giving up alcohol.
So what
explore giving up alcohol.
So what behaviors I had wanted me to give up alcohol? Related to alcohol, like, what was it that I was doing that was like, oh, why is alcohol a problem?
Like, how did it become apparent to you that you connected the dots that alcohol was causing more harm than?
Well, there's a few different layers to this. One of them was given to me right out of the gate when I was a child, saying, if you, from my parents, who are both sober, if you ever drink, you are an alcoholic, because it's in our family, it's genetic, and you don't have a choice. And they didn't exactly say it like that, but that was the way I received it. I do have a lot of people on both my mother's side of the family and my father's side who drank very heavily, who used drugs. It wasn't apparent in the in my interactions with them, because a lot of them had stopped using drugs at that point when I was young. I never saw my mother drink. She was sober before I was born. But the narrative was that it was really dangerous to drink, and not just because, you know, they never really talked about alcohol is bad for you on a physiological level. They just said, it's bad for you because
you have this
disease.
Right.
This genetic thing.
And that's kind of comes back, not to interrupt you, but like that always didn't sit well with me, as I'm sure we'll talk about in the future, but mm-hmm. because I didn't understand it. So it's like,
right.
I was like, why? Why is this a disease? Why is this like, where's the scientific, you know?
Right. And I didn't think about the scientific stuff
right.
for years. I just was in this mindset of, I don't want to have this label put on right. me. I want to explore it.
Do you think it actually like pushed you to try alcohol in a way?
Well.
Or do you think it just would have happened because of social?
There's a combination there because when I would tell my mother, my friends, everyone that I would never take a sip of alcohol my entire life. My favorite line was when I got married, I wouldn't even have a sip of champagne. I was like, when I was a teenager, I would tell
that.
People that. Oh yeah.
Interesting.
I was adamant that I would never ever try anything. Hmm. And then when I was 16, I started taking birth control and the hormones really messed me up.
Yeah.
And I went through a really bad breakup. Mm-hmm. And I had all these things impacting my 16. Mental health. God, 16. What a year. Sweet 16.
Right. So sweet.
So sweet. And it felt like a spontaneous decision mm-hmm. of like, oh, I'm going to try alcohol. Mm-hmm. But it had been impacted by all of this other right. stuff going right. on. And I didn't drink very much and I felt so much guilt the first time. Mm-hmm. I didn't drink very much until I was 18. And then it was just like a landslide.
Yeah.
And there were so many other things going on mm-hmm. that were impacting my mental health,
right.
my environment, that weren't being addressed. Mm-hmm. And my mindset was, oh, I've gone down this path because I'm an alcoholic and this is inevitable.
Right, right.
And I would just go ham.
Yeah, it's almost like a
self-fulfilling prophecy. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, manifest destiny.
Well, I think also when you accept that, like I went through a phase too where I was like, this is just what's happening.
Yeah.
It's almost like a level of denial, I guess, because mm-hmm. you're able to just justify your behavior because you're like, it would have happened anyway.
Sure.
Right.
Sure. So then years later, I always had this cloud over me saying like, this is a problem. Mm-hmm. It's going to be a problem. It mm-hmm. always was a problem. But then it wasn't until my mid to late 20s and even early 20s, there were problems. Mm-hmm. But it was interesting. It wasn't until things started to get better. Because shit just kept cycling and growing. But it wasn't until things started to get better where I was changing things in my life that I was seeing that it wasn't that I was seeing all of a sudden this is a problem and I need to stop. That was a component. I knew mm-hmm. that it was unhealthy physically and mentally. But it was where I thought, oh, things can get better mm-hmm. and this doesn't have to be a life sentence that I am an alcoholic. I didn't see myself as like, I need to stop drinking because I have a disease. I saw that doing positive things made me feel better and I didn't feel like drinking as much
right.
anymore. And then I was like, well, what am I capable of if I cut it out completely? Mm-hmm. And that's when I started exploring more about, you know, other things. So it was the, you know, getting into running and like mm-hmm. eating differently and having a better social network and pursuing intellectual things and like going back to college that I was like, oh, I could do that.
Hmm.
Yeah.
That's
and started
cool.
questioning the,
yeah, yeah.
the disease narrative.
Right.
Yeah.
That's
what
really
about,
interesting.
Yeah. What about you? What do you?
Woof. I guess, so what's interesting is it came down to my anxiety. Like the real reason why I was able to really accept the notion of not drinking ever again was because my anxiety got so crippling that it was like something I couldn't bear any longer.
Mm-hmm.
But it's interesting looking back because it also started with anxiety. Because when I was 15 or 16, the first time I ever drank was with like a guy I had a crush on, and I was insanely nervous and shy.
Mm-hmm.
And they were partying and they were like, here, do a beer bong, whatever. And like literally, I think from that moment on, I like a switch flipped where I was like, oh, this gets rid of that feeling. Like, if you do this, your social anxiety
sure,
is gone.
Sure, yeah.
Which I now know is literally just like numbing it and putting it to the side and not necessarily creating any deeper connection or anything that you think you're creating. But so I was really young when I started binge drinking, which like statistics show too that that like increases your chances of abusing alcohol.
Mm-hmm.
I also had role models who used alcohol very frequently mm-hmm. as adults in my life
mm-hmm.
that kind of painted a picture, I think, that like it was normal and okay to drink a lot, and that you could still like totally function and be a normal person in society with alcohol being like a main focus in your life.
Mm-hmm.
But it was always fun and social. Like, I only drank socially, but it was a lot, like every weekend. So it was kind of like, I even in college, I had a friend pass away, and I dropped out of school for a semester and just like drank all the time with my friends, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But it was always with other people. It was always a social thing. It was always like seemingly very normal and okay because that's the universe I lived in, right? So mm-hmm. like everyone was doing the same thing. And then after college, I kind of like switched it to that work hard, play hard mentality. Like, I never drank during the week, but weekends we would go out and like get wild and then be hungover and, you know, like watch TV all day on Sunday or whatever we were doing. And that seemed very normal too, because I like had my buddies that I did that with, and it seemed like everyone was doing the same thing. And what's funny is in sobriety, I now know that most people remain relatively the same when they're drunk. Like, they don't light up and like turn into a different person and like get really energized and loud and whatever. And I in my mind thought that everyone was like me, so the fact that I was behaving that way felt like, again, very normal. I thought that's how everyone was. It wasn't until I got into the service industry after a layoff when I was like 26 27, and that really, I think, like, I'd always kind of like stayed safe because of the work hard, play hard mentality. Like, I never drank alone. I didn't drink during the week. I didn't like there were all these like rules that I was following that made it okay.
Mm-hmm.
And then when I got into the service industry, it was like game over.
Yeah.
Didn't have to be at work till 4 every day. Everyone was on the same page. So it was like you went out after work every single night.
Oh, yeah, restaurant culture.
Yeah, you knew everyone in the industry, so you drank for free a lot. Like, it was just very normal.
Mm-hmm.
And that's really when it just, like, there's no other word for it other than, like, spinning totally out of control. Like, I started having friends be really concerned. I was told by a lot of people that they wouldn't be around me when I was drinking. And it's fascinating because it did get, it's progressive, like the way that alcohol affects you, like your physical and mental state is like, it does just get worse and worse. So like, I would black out faster. I would get drunk like off of one glass of wine and be like, you know, physically like very different than I was sober. So yeah, I guess it's just interesting looking back because what drove me to pursue sobriety was my anxiety, but that's what started it in the first place. And the more you learn about the cycle of alcohol is that most people use it to cope with stress and anxiety.
Sure.
But then the withdrawal is stress and anxiety.
Oh, yeah.
So you're just like perpetuating a cycle of anxiety and withdrawal, anxiety and withdrawal.
Oh, you know? Yeah.
So, but yeah. I guess that's...
Yeah, that whole, like, anxiety and withdrawal, you know, there's, for me, I was, like, I remember being, in high school, and I was a really good student, and I loved what I was doing in school, but I did have, like, had anxiety sometimes. There it would ebb and flow, and then when I started drinking in college, it was a very anxious environment for me, and I do feel that I was in some ways ill prepared for how much I was going to take on.
Right.
Neither of my parents had been to college, and when I would talk to them about it, they were just kind of, my mom was helpful, but only so much as she could be.
Right.
And so I just felt really overwhelmed, and I don't think I had ever really been taught tools to handle my anxiety.
Right.
And drinking just exacerbated it and made it worse. And behavior started popping up. I guess you could call them panic attacks. They were like maybe almost like a temper tantrum.
That's literally what it was.
Was that a behavior from my childhood
was coming up.
Was resurfacing. And because my brain was like not able to handle this stuff that I could have maybe handled. But with alcohol, it just,
well, I think when you start using alcohol to cope for any reason, young, and by young, I mean, like, before 25, that's what you use to cope. I mean, it's like anything. If you get in the habit of using that as a coping mechanism and your brain is like, oh, this works. Like, so for me, it went from anxiety to, like, as I became an adult, like, oh, I'm supposed to get a good job and I'm supposed to, like, be successful, and I'm supposed to not let my parents down, and I'm supposed to buy a house, and I'm supposed to, like, save for retirement, and I'm supposed to do all these things. So alcohol literally enabled me to be like, nope, don't want to think about that. Like, just procrastinate many things. And that was like, it was a tool for me to procrastinate the things that I thought I deserved and wanted in my life. And also to cope with, like, the pressure that we all have. And we're not taught to, like, I mean, some people are. Some people are given the tools. But in general, I think a lot of people feel that way where they don't know how to act or do things. And so it's like, yeah, it's interesting.
Well, yeah, and being aware of what your feelings are and that it's okay to have the stress.
And let that, like, propel you to make change. Instead of,
I think there's this interesting balance or range between stress that will propel you to make changes, or stress that immobilizes you, and it's not always impacted by alcohol. Well, it is impacted by alcohol. But, I mean, for some people, there is just this level of stress that... I don't know if suffocates the right word. But, like, that, yeah, immobilizes, keeps them from making a change. So, so how much stress is there enough to make you... go on to the next level in your life? Or is it just this death cycle? And I wonder about that, where I see all these people that aren't, that are unhappy, but it's not enough to make them change. And then what was it that made me able to make change? And not necessarily, like, fixing everything, obviously. Like, I think that that's part of the reason I, you know, want to do this whole thing, is that, like, there are still things.
I know, a lot of people will say that in sobriety, problems are not fixed, they're amplified. But it's like you learn the tools to work through things and face them. And although that's much harder than procrastinating or numbing something, it's you know, in the end, it's much more beneficial to your well-being.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So alcohol, we can agree, was like a coping mechanism for both of us, right?
For sure.
And is for a lot of people. And that's something that I had touched on with my family having the narrative that they had alcoholism,
right.
and that alcohol was bad. My mindset currently mm-hmm. is that alcoholism is not a disease, that it's not a life sentence,
right?
But that their alcohol is it is addictive. It is physiologically and psychologically damaging.
Yes.
And that far more people in the population mm-hmm. are using it as that coping mechanism than just people who are quote-unquote alcoholics.
Absolutely.
And so one thing I wanted to kind of touch on is like, what are some of these, recognizing that, what are some of the other coping mechanisms?
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, we could talk all day and we can talk more about alcohol in future things, but I think it's really important to bring light to the fact that alcohol is one of those things,
mm-hmm.
but what are the other things that we're using that are like an addiction that you could, you know, that mm-hmm. people are using to cope? And then how do you handle the stress? Like, how do you deal with the underlying things?
Right.
So what would be some other coping mechanisms that you either you've experienced or that you see that you think of maybe as synonymous as alcohol?
So the first thing that comes to mind is food, because I think that our culture uses food as a coping mechanism almost like to the same degree as alcohol.
Mm.
And with that, I think that like the behavior of changing those coping mechanisms, I mean, it is all the same. So once you figure out the formula of how to basically, like, the way your brain works is when you're using a coping mechanism, you're creating pathways in your brain in order to basically, like, survive. Like, you're telling your brain, like, okay, do this in this situation.
Mm-hmm.
And the more you do it, the deeper those pathways get, and the more it's easy to turn to that instead of something else.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, I don't know, being alive right now is really interesting because we're constantly bombarded by stress and environmental factors that kind of like put a wrench in our innate ability to take care of ourselves. But
mm-hmm.
with food, it's like kind of taught to us because of the way that like capitalism and the food industry works. We're given subliminal messaging a lot, just like alcohol, that it is like will make you happy and make you feel better about yourself. And yeah, like you just you're basically like subliminally taught to use these things as coping mechanisms.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that one thing that I explored when I stopped drinking was like, because it took me a couple tries, as it takes most people.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I realized that one thing that was missing the first time I drank or I stopped drinking was I didn't really work that hard at replacing the behavior with a healthier mm-hmm. behavior. Mm-hmm. I just took out the behavior. So mm-hmm. I was like, okay, all you have to do is stop drinking. That's all you have to do. You're good. Just stop doing that thing.
Right.
And the truth is that your brain doesn't work that way. So, like, when you stop doing a behavior that's unhealthy, you have to replace it with a healthy behavior. And you have to teach, and it can be multiple healthy behaviors, but you have to teach yourself, at the most basic level, it would be, like, if I feel, you know, tempted to use alcohol to deal with social anxiety,
mm-hmm.
you have to have something in your arsenal immediately to be, like, well, what do? Well, I go get a soda water with bitters and lime
mm-hmm.
and then, you know, whatever. Take a moment to take a couple deep breaths and, like, observe my environment. But I think that's just, like, a really important factor with when we talk about coping mechanisms that maybe people don't realize is that you're always going to have to use coping mechanisms no matter what. That's just like a human trait that we have in order to cope with things. But being cognizant of how to shift that focus into healthy coping mechanisms mm-hmm. is, like, I think, really crucial to changing any behavior.
Yes.
I'm not sure if that answered your question, but
no. Yeah, that's one level of it, and we can always come back to it and explore more about it. Yeah, that concept of how this is a pattern of behavior, and that you can take out the behavior, but that the neurologically speaking, you have these pathways in your brain that this is your brain has learned that we do this in right. this way.
She's moving her hands.
I'm moving my hand.
In a we, river.
You
path.
Go down a path. And that's, I mean, you could even relate this to like a trigger. So right. like if you see something and every time you see that, like Pavlov's dogs, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so for anyone, if you're not familiar, like Pavlov has these dogs, he rings a bell, and when he rings the bell, he gives them food. And so it gets to the point where...
That's how we train our parrot.
Yeah.
Wumpo.
Yeah. Yeah. You give the... And so when you... It got to the point where Pavlov could ring the bell and the dogs would automatically salivate. They have right. already associated the bell right. with the food. I read something recently. Another thing that Pavlov worked on was... and it was kind of by accident, there was a flood in his lab, and the dogs that he had there, their cages had been flooded, and no one was there. And when they drained the cages and they got the dogs out, they rescued the dogs, they were okay, but they were traumatized mm. by this. And mm. from that point on, they learned a specific set of behaviors to handle their stress. Mm-hmm. They were permanently traumatized.
Right.
And that's a whole other thing. It would be great to get into, you know, the psychology of that. But you learn without even realizing it. You associate certain behaviors and certain actions with certain feelings.
Right.
And so how do you put something else in there? How do you shift that? And right. Food is a really good one. I mean, when I stopped drinking, I had already started working out quite a bit, mm-hmm. and then I replaced it with, I wouldn't say necessarily replaced drinking with working out, and I have been accused of that, where people are like, oh, you just replaced it with something else, mm-hmm. and I was like, well, I may still have things to work on, but I would argue that...
But that's the thing, though, is you're, like, when people use that analogy, I think it's kind of misled, because... You're always going to have to cope. Like, you always have to have behaviors in your life that
right.
help you deal with
right.
stress.
Right.
So, yeah, of course you're replacing right. the behavior. Obviously, you don't want to be, like, fanatical about it mm-hmm. the way that you were maybe fanatical about using alcohol. But, right. like, yeah, it's
There's
funny.
A, yeah.
Because people say that a lot. And it's right. like, well, what do you want me to do?
and then the other part of it is that... Excuse me. There's the fact that we're always going to have stress to mm-hmm. deal with. Mm-hmm. But what I became really interested in, I didn't look at, when I first stopped drinking, I wasn't looking as much at, okay, how do I handle the stress?
Right.
I was looking at, why are we stressed?
Mm-hmm. That's interesting.
How can we remove the stress?
Right.
Or... Like, what is going on that is making us so freaking anxious?
Yeah.
And I really appreciate coming to a place in my life where I am looking at different coping mechanisms and looking at how to handle the stress. Because you're right. Like, you're never not going to have stress.
Right.
But the level of which we have stress and where right. it's
you
coming
can
from.
To a degree, your environment. Yeah.
You can control. You can be aware of it. Mm-hmm. And this is something that, as I've gotten more involved in exercise mm-hmm. and learning about when and why people exercise and how motivated people are, mm-hmm. or like how tired you are.
Motivation's a myth.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So.
Sidebar.
Yeah, well, I would say
the way that people perceive motivation is a myth. Mm-hmm. I think that what people actually are seeking is, like, people think that you're just intrinsically motivated. Like, some people
right.
are just, like, motivated to do shit or to work out without any, like, external factors going on.
Mm-hmm.
But I think what they're confusing that for is that motivated people have figured out their reason for doing something and then do it when they don't want to do it, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So it's like learning that that's something that anyone's capable of.
Sure, you know? Sure, yeah. But yeah, so...
little sidebar from the sidebar personal trainer.
Can, yeah, yeah, yeah. That'd be something we should explore
maybe
more.
Talk about, yeah.
Yeah. So yeah, like, the things that I started looking at were... I read a really great book called The Nature Fix.
Mm-hmm.
And talked about how being inside an office all day, so say you have like typical person, or you know, one type of typical person in America who works in an office all day and they're tired at the end of the day and they go home and they want to work out. They have that desire,
mm-hmm.
but then they're just exhausted, and so they go out with friends and they have drinks.
Mm-hmm.
I'm
like, that sounds exhausting.
And now I'm like, in retrospect, that sounds exhausting. But that seems to them to be something to unwind, relax, right? And they're like, okay, I really want to work out, but like, these things keep coming up, or I just don't feel like it, and I'm frustrated. I don't know if you... So, how do you... You can look at, like, they're stressed and coping with the stress, but what if you can look at the environment and just decrease the stress that's happening, that's creating this problem in the first place?
Mm-hmm.
So, the fact that Nature Fix talks about how just being inside...
Mm-hmm.
In a building away from nature, where you have fake lights, you don't have real sunlight, you're not outside,
AC,
you don't
fake
have
air.
Yeah, AC, fake air,
mm-hmm.
You have visually unstimulating and kind of stressful things mm-hmm. inside an office in a building. These are causing stressors that you're not necessarily cognizant of.
Yeah,
you're not aware of it, but it's stressing out your body. It's increasing your blood pressure, mm-hmm. increasing your cortisol, and then at the end of the day, your brain is like, oh my God, I'm so done.
Well, a lot of people argue that even getting in a car is like traumatic for human beings, so
yes.
we do that every day.
Yep, we do that every day, yeah. And so then you get done, and also in an office, you don't see many people.
Mm-hmm.
Like maybe you have a team you work with or like you're talking to people on your computer or maybe on the phone, but we're incredibly social creatures. Mm-hmm. We need people. And so when you get done that day and your brain is like, go see your friends and have drinks, that's not a bad thing. That's a completely understandable,
normal
desire.
Mm-hmm.
And not wanting to work out, like, yeah, that's understandable. You're exhausted. So, like, how can you... I'm not saying, like, everyone should just quit their jobs.
Right.
Right?
It's
but
not practical.
But it's, like, looking at this environment and saying... And giving yourself a break and being like, oh, it's not necessarily my fault.
Mm-hmm.
There are things you can do to change it, but, like, not to badger yourself if you don't have, quote-unquote, motivation to do things.
I think this is a really interesting topic because I don't think many people are like cognizant of that playing a part in their like feeling unmotivated to work out after work.
Sure.
I think that people, and this is an assumption and I may be wrong, but I think people tend to be like, I'm exhausted, and then look to the next thing. They don't say, I'm exhausted, how can I look behind me?
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Mm-hmm.
It's like, you feel a certain way, so you look for a fix. You don't feel a certain way and look for, like, a solution to the problem before it happens, I guess, is what
mm-hmm.
I'm saying.
Yes.
And actually, I haven't even really thought about that a whole lot, which is super interesting, because something I talk about a lot with my clients with when we work on, like, one of the first things I work on is stress and sleep quality with all my clients, because I might be a personal trainer, but that's like an extremely important integral part of your health. And typically I find that people are stressed in a lot of ways where they don't even realize that it's causing them stress, which manifests in all kinds of health issues. But so I think that could be really powerful of, like, figuring out ways to, because I guess I do explore ways to de-stress your day, but I'm not usually exploring the environment that much. Mm-hmm. So, like, actions you can take are kind of my focus a lot of the time.
Sure.
But it's funny that you mentioned that, because it's like little things like having a plant on your desk would probably help a lot, or being sure to take a walk at lunchtime if you have, like, a trail nearby with trees, you know, like getting outside and getting fresh air. And
we as a culture will talk about that. Well, you know, we recommend for exercise, like, start with going for a walk and, like, ways 100%. To lower blood pressure.
Right.
But the association is that the physiological...
The movement not what's around you.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which is crazy, because being from Oregon, I walk into a forest when I'm home, like, if we go on a hike, and I immediately feel calmer. I mean, it is overwhelming. Like, I'm like, okay, everything is fine, you know? Mm-hmm. So it's like... And I know that you've done more research on that, but there is actually chemicals that happen when you're... submersed in nature that act as, like, a calming
effect, there's
being in, like, concrete jungle all the time is probably extremely stressful.
It is and you know, I don't want to say all one way or the other, the truth of the matter is,
well, it's the reality that we live in, you know.
Well, there's that, but it's also that I grew up in Vermont in the woods. It couldn't have been more natural. And yet I was stressed and I did have anxiety and I did have, you know, there were other stressors in it. It was not like you can just live in the woods and that's going to fix all your problems.
Right.
And moving to Austin, sometimes I like to walk around downtown and I get this euphoric excitement from walking around. Now, despite the fact that it's counterintuitive to what I'm describing in terms of a natural environment, quote unquote, there's something about being with a bunch of people and seeing them all do their thing that I get excited about and is, like, helping me in mental health in some way. So there's different levels to it.
Right, right.
But it is something that we just don't really think about. And I see a lot in popular culture and especially in workout stuff that is putting a lot of pressure on an individual and saying, like, all of the choices you're making are internally...
Totally.
I manifested.
Agree with that.
Right?
Yeah.
And
which is not fair.
It's not fair. There's so... There's this great book called Selfie by Will Storr.
I've heard of that. I haven't read it, though.
And I actually have... I haven't read the whole thing yet, but... And I heard an interview with him on the Ezra Klein show. And he says, every part of our individual being is coming from an outside influence.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And whether you completely profess to that, right, people don't like that. And you don't have to go whole hog on that and, like, 10,000% agree with that. But,
right. But it's an interesting thing to
think about.
It is
an interesting thing. And, like, to be maybe more conscientious of, like, oh, yeah, a lot of what I see as being me is coming from the world around us. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And there is also, there is a lot of neurochemical things that are creating an individual self, and that's a whole other thing we could talk about. But just being gracious with yourself, that's a big reason why I wanted to do this, was, like, to be able to talk to people and talk with you about how it's not all just within ourselves.
Totally.
Yeah.
I think that's something that is really powerful in health and wellness, because, I mean, like, the whole self-care thing is really big right now, and I think it's a great concept, but I think that one crucial piece that's missing is that it's not really about taking action to take care of yourself. It's like starting from a place of acceptance, of like knowing that you will have these outside influences that are out of your control, mm-hmm. or environmental factors or constructs that are like completely ingrained in you, or sure. whatever, that haven't really been like your choice. Sure. And so coming from a place of, yeah, like graciousness with yourself is super important, because then I think right. you just make better decisions if you're able to like let go of the pressures that are put on you to take care of yourself, and you turn to just like, I don't know how to describe it, but just like being less obsessively calculated mm-hmm. with taking care of yourself, and mm-hmm. just like doing what is good for you,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's hard to explain.
It is. I mean, these are complex things. For me, I found a lot of, I found guidance in looking at, well, as this podcast is called, the structures of self, the structures, mm-hmm. these things outside of us, mm-hmm. whether it's like systemically happening in society, and like these constructs of right. society, on a social level, on a physical level, in the environment, and just these invisible things that are influencing us mm-hmm. and contributing to our behavior in ways that we aren't cognizant of. And, you know, I talked to someone about this like 6 months ago, and he had said that if you, I think he used the word blame, if you blame all your actions on outside forces, then you aren't taking responsibility, and that you are...
But I think what you're saying is that there's both.
Right.
People don't consider the outside factor as much as they should, because everyone sure. is, like, manifesting their own
right.
controlled destiny or whatever. And that's, like, the focus right now, when really, for most people, there's a lot of things out of our control that you have to consider.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right, right. And that it doesn't have to be all or the other.
Right.
Either.
Right.
It is a balance of both.
Yeah. Nothing should ever be black and white. And mm-hmm. So that's another topic, is mm-hmm. why humans love black and white thinking. Because mm. it's like so ingrained in us, and it's so, mm-hmm. I think, detrimental to like our overall well-being a lot of the time.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, that's a whole other thing we can get into. But yeah, looking at bigger picture things and being able to identify specific labels for things, but right. also see the crossover
right.
Our society doesn't always do that very well.
Right.
And I mean, that goes back to biologically, like, you need to identify something specifically mm-hmm. so you know whether it helps you or hurts
or
you.
Hurts you, yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot there, yeah.
All right. I think that we covered everything we had planned on talking about today.
Yeah. Thank you so much for listening to our first episode.
Yeah, we had no idea what we were doing,
we
so thanks
not.
For bearing with us.
Yeah, our
amateur hour.
Yeah. But the first episode of Structures of Self.
Structures of Self.
There will be many more topics to unpack and uncover and explore between our experiences and the larger realm of society and science yeah. and all sorts of things. So tune in for more yeah. fun stuff.
Thanks for listening.
Thank you for listening, y'all.